There can be bad language and adult concepts in this program. So please watch out for little ears if you've got your podcast playing and pop on some headphones. That way no one can get offended but you.
What you're doing as a historical fiction writer is you're trying to give people a notion of the person, a notion of the character.
You're listening to the Rights for Women podcast, where we celebrate women writers, support women's rights, and talk all things women and writing. I'm Kel Butler, podcaster and wannabe author. I'm founder of Listen Up Podcasting, where we make podcasts for a positive world. Check me out at www.listenuppodcasting.com.au or find me on Facebook.
And I'm Pamela Cook, author of 5 novels, 4 traditionally published and 1 indie release. I'm a writing teacher and a podcaster. My latest release, Cross My Heart, is available now at all online retailers and at pamelacook.com.au.
Listen to all of our episodes at www.rightsforwomen.com or subscribe wherever you get your pods. Today on Anatomy of a Novel, we're investigating how to write works of fiction from the truths of history. To take us through this fascinating writing process is award-winning Australian crime author, Solari Gentile. Solari has written 2 series steeped in history and history's machinations. The award-winning and best-selling Roland Sinclair Mysteries, the latest of which we will use today as a case study for this interview. And the Greek mythology adventure series, The Hero Trilogy. Solari also took out the Best Crime Award at the 2018 Ned Kelly Awards for her book, Crossing the Lines. Solari began her career as a corporate lawyer before realizing her true passion was with the written word, and she's been writing from history's pages ever since, with the help of her historian husband. We can't think of a better person today than Solari Gentile to take us through writing from the pages of history. Thank you for joining us today, Solari.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Kel.
It really is. I love doing chats with you. Now, I actually would like you to start today because we're going to be using your book, A Testament of Character, which is the 10th book in the Roland Sinclair Mystery Series. Can't believe it's 10 books now. How does that make you feel? Just quickly.
Slightly old, a little tired, but actually really excited. I always knew that this series would be a long series. And I feel very privileged that the reading public has allowed me to go on for 10 books.
Well, it's certainly a really popular series, and it's even popular internationally. And this book you released not long ago, just a couple of months ago, is that right?
Yeah, it came out in March, right at the beginning of the pandemic.
Just in time for everyone to go into isolation and no one to launch a book.
in a stroke of marketing genius.
Well, very quickly, what I might get you to do for the listeners who don't know about the Roland Sinclair Mysteries is just give a brief overview as to this series of books and the beautiful characters that you have that go throughout them, which is Roland, Edna, Milt and Clyde. Can you just give us a rundown?
Yeah, sure. So the series generally takes place in that period between the wars, or it has to date. The first book began in 1932, and A Testament of Character is written up until the beginning of 1936. So in 10 books, I've gone 4 years. The central character is Roland Sinclair. Now, the series, as I said, takes place between the wars. He's a gentleman of a very illustrious family background. In 1932, he's 27, and he ages with the chronology of the books. So at the moment that I'm writing him, he's 30. Roland was born to a very wealthy pastoral family. So anyone who knows anything about the pastoral families of New South Wales of that era, they had so much wealth that they could not possibly spend it in one generation. So that's the kind of family to which he was born. His elder brother is a bastion of society. He's quite a bit older than Roland, and he is a pillar of conservatism. Roland was brought up in that same vein, but he has an artistic flair. He draws and he paints, and as a natural consequence of being drawn towards the artistic, he's also drawn towards the artistic set of Sydney, who were notoriously left-wing and often communist. So I have this young man who walks the line between his very conservative and wealthy background and the friends he's made who are very left-wing and often penniless. Roland lives in a mansion in Wallara, which he has opened to his penniless and louche companions. In that house, living with him as his permanent house guest of sorts, is the great love of his life, Edna Higgins. Edna is a sculptress. She's fiercely independent, fiercely ambitious, and so not just beautiful, but so enigmatic and individual that men fall in love with her all around the place. And Roland is one of those. But Edna always keeps her friendships and her loves separate. She considers the men who she will allow to be her lovers as disposable, and she is very loyal to her friends. So in that vein, poor Roland never gets a chance to move beyond friendship with Edna, and she remains his unrequited love for many of the books, at least. Also living in that house is Milton, who is a childhood friend of Edna's, Milton Isaacs. His real name is Elias Isaac, but he's given the moniker Milton because he has a propensity to quote the romantic bards without attribution. So his name or his reputation as a poet is really established through plagiarizing and stealing the words of others, and his fondness for quoting great works of poetry without ever mentioning that they belong to someone else. And he has such a natural flair and bombast about him that people just assume that they are his words. Of course, Roland Sinclair, with his very traditional British education, is able to identify where the words originally came from, and this turns into a kind of motif between the two of them, where Milton quotes and Roland attributes the quote to its actual author. And Milton, of course, couldn't care less. He carries on. And then the fourth person in that inner circle, or that group, is Clyde Watson Jones. And Clyde Watson Jones is a fellow artist, but he is from very different circumstances to Roland. He spent a lot of his time before he met Roland living on the Wallaby, moving from town to town, trying to get work. He's from the country. His parents live in the house across the road from mine in Batlow, and they would have in the 1930s, and they are very wholesome, very Catholic, down-to-earth people who he has told that he is working as Roland's mechanic because they wouldn't understand why he's living in this artistic commune in Wallara. So that's the inner circle of Roland Sinclair, and it is amongst those friends that he investigates crime, and he doesn't ever do it on purpose. He's just one of those unlucky people that seems to stumble upon any dead body that's happening to lie around.
Yeah, he actually reminds me a little bit when I read it. It's kind of like a mix of, say, Sherlock Holmes or Poirot, but with Robin Hood and the Band of Merry Men.
It does seem that way. It has been described to me as Rolly and his Scooby gang.
Oh, yes! Yes!
And, And it, they are very witty, lighthearted, fun people to be around. But the actual series is about that time between the wars in the 1930s, where all the tensions developed that led to World War II. So the series is really about the rise of fascism and the patterns that I can see are very similar to the patterns that are developing today. So I use the series not only to explore what happened in the past, but to actually think about and explore what's happening now in our own world.
Yeah, it was really obvious just then when you were talking about the world and the characters that you created, how it, there are the different contrasts of elements of life. You can see already just through those characters that you're setting up the dynamics to have those conversations just through the blueprint of the series.
Yeah, look, it didn't ever feel like when I was creating these characters, it didn't ever feel like I had an agenda. You know, I wanted Edna to represent a new woman in feminism or anything as overt as that. It was more that I create, or Roland Sinclair seemed to emerge from the page, and he attracted to him these themes and these people who played into those themes. So they seem to be a very balanced group with which to face the world.
Yeah, I agree. I think you have struck this beautiful balance, and because there's four of them, it creates balance straight away. Whereas if it was three, that sense of three, there's always an imbalance of someone getting sort of slightly left out, but it's this situation of the four, and I really like that as well. I do want to go a lot more into all the things we've just touched on, but before we do, would you mind just reading the first chapter of A Testament of Character up to the point where Edna turns to Roland and says, "Oh, Rolly, I'm so sorry."
Okay, sure. Chapter 1, Singapore Base, London, Tuesday. Speaking at the 1912 Club, Lord Hallisham's private secretary, Captain Graham, said, "If we lose Singapore as a base, we lose every part of the empire east and south of Singapore." Goulburn Evening Post, 13th of February, 1935. The doors which led out to the suite's balcony were open to the brewing storm outside. Heavy clouds churned overhead without releasing their burden, but the wind already carried the scent of rain and jasmine. The gentleman who leaned out on the railing wore a dinner suit, traditional black as opposed to the white jackets that were popular in the tropics. The sharp part of his dark hair had been lost in the building gusts, yet he seemed oblivious to the oncoming tempest. Roland Sinclair unknotted his bow tie with one hand as he read the letter he held in the other. A missive summoning him back to Sydney at the earliest convenience, issued by his elder brother, Wilfred, upon whom the mantle and burden of family power had settled. The letter mentioned that there were papers and affairs that required his attention. Roland doubted that was true. The commercial machinations of the Sinclair fortune had been designed by Wilfred to require very little from Roland beyond an occasional directed signature. It was an arrangement with which they were both happy. Pulling the tie free of his collar, Roland folded the page and shoved both into his pocket. Roland and his friends had been in the East for 6 months now, most of it in Shanghai, the last 4 weeks here in Singapore. The animosity which had made his exit from Australia to China seem expedient and timely would by now have settled. Surely. Clearly Wilfred believed so, or he would have sent his brother on some other errand abroad. Of course, the sojourn to Shanghai had not proved to be as effective in keeping Roland out of harm's way as Wilfred had hoped. The treaty port was rife with violence and treachery, in which they'd found themselves embroiled. But they had come out of it more or less intact. They'd lingered in Singapore longer than intended. Wilfred had asked his brother to look into the progress of the massive naval base being built on the island. The construction, begun well over a decade before, had been fraught with delays and changes in policy, but had, with the increase in Japanese aggression in the region, been given new priority. Roland was not sure of the exact nature of Wilfred's interest in the massive King George VI dry dock, but he had toured the facility, gaining access via his brother's connections, and reported back as asked. It had not been uninteresting, and he had found himself fascinated with the engineering might behind the build. Throughout their time in Singapore, the Raffles Hotel had provided a very comfortable place of repose, with pleasant evenings of cards and conversation fueled by ginsengs. But Roland had been ready to go home for some time. Of course, that was impossible now. He reached into his other pocket and extracted the telegram he had received at the same time as Wilfred's letter. The thin paper was creased, crumpled in grief and shock. But now, here, alone, he allowed the impact of its message to wind in with the loss. A tentative knock on the door to the suite and a head peered cautiously around it. Long hair for a man, dark features, and a white dinner jacket embellished with a feathered buttonhole of the flamboyant wearer's own making. "Rolly, are you alone?" Milton Isaacs came in. The poet shook his head in disgust to find that Roland was indeed on his own. "Where is..." Roland's gaze remained fixed on the impending squall. "I accompanied Lady Waldridge to her room and said good night," he replied vaguely. He had been handed both envelopes as he and Persephone Woolridge had left the long bar in search of somewhere more private. Naturally, Roland had read the telegram immediately, and Persephone had been somewhat unhappy when he'd withdrawn from their plans for the evening. Milton heard something in Roland's voice that startled him. He noticed how now the distinctive pink leaf of telegram paper. What's happened? Two more people entered the suite before Roland could answer, laughing as they stepped into the room. Brawny Clyde Watson-Jones, who even after all these years in Roland Sinclair's company looked out of place in formal attire. His sun-lined face spoke of a much harder life than that experienced in the luxury of hotels such as Raffles. And Miss Edna Higgins, the beautiful, uninhibited sculptress who had been Roland's muse since the day they met. They made up the rest of Roland's party, a tight, loyal set who lived and created and played together under the benevolence and almost incomprehensible wealth of the Sinclairs. It was not to any of their minds an uneven relationship. They all shared everything they had. It was just that Roland had so much more. Milton shot Clyde a glance. Something was wrong. Edna didn't need Milton's warning. She sensed it immediately. The laughter fell silent and she unhooked her arm from Clyde's to go to Roland. She reached up to turn his face towards hers. Roland's dark blue eyes seemed grey, like the storm. There was a kind of restrained anguish in his face. "Rolly?" Edna said, frightened now. "What is it?" She looked down at the telegram. "Who is it?" Roland handed her the page. "Danny." "Cartwright?" Edna read. "We regret to inform you that Daniel Fullerton Cartwright died this morning." There was more, but she could not see because of the tears, for Danny Cartwright, who years ago had welcomed them to his home in New York, who had been kind and generous and absurd, and for Roland, who had known him for years before that and who carried his friendships close to his heart. "Oh, Rolly, I'm so sorry."
Thank you so much. I think that initial opening is one of the most perfect sort of encapsulations of an entire series in a manner of pages and all the relationships that go with it that I've ever seen.
Thank you. It is a challenge for each book when you get into a long series to actually try and bring new readers into the space that people who have read the 9 books before are in.
Because they're standalone as well, aren't they? You write them so that people can actually read them as individual books but also be connected into the series.
Yeah, you want people to be able to enter at any point. And whether they go back and read the other books or not, they should be able to get the experience that you want them to from the book that they have before them.
and also get a really amazing understanding of the tenderness of the relationships and the depth of the relationships and the complexities going on. And just in that very short introduction, and bam, there you've got your challenge and your problem right there. You know, you're in, you're caught.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it was, I think in some ways having those four characters and the nature of their relationship is now so known to me. And it's still surprising, it's still evolving, but it's so deep and naturally tender that all the writing and the dialogue that falls around them seems to come really naturally. So those parts of the book where they're all in the same room are really easy to write because it feels very much like I'm just watching as they talk to each other.
How interesting, like an out-of-body experience, and you're channeling them as a group.
Absolutely. They each have their individual stories and they each have their individual secrets even from each other. But something about the connection between them is so beautifully strong and seems to work so incredibly well that it's carried through and developed through 10 books very, very easily.
Well, through reading just even that small section, there's a few key elements that I can see you'd have to be working with all the time if you're writing from history. And I'm actually going to rewind you all the way back to when you started writing from history. But in this moment, I just sort of want to pull out just from that little passage, you're dealing with the language of the time. You're dealing with the way they move in the time because it's so different to now. You're dealing with the way they dress based on who they are and how you're representing them once again for the time. You're dealing with the politics of the time. You're dealing with the interplay of relationships and families. You're dealing with the time and space itself. And you've got so many tiny accuracies and details which will allow an authentic experience for a reader to be transported back into history and feel like they're truly there. So I guess when you're formulating a book formed from history, where do you begin with all of that?
For me, so going back to my process, I'm on the extreme end of pantsers. So when you look at writers who exist on a spectrum from the extreme plotters who write plots that are longer than the final book, to the other end of the scale, the extreme pantsers who have no idea what their book is about, but they just sit down and write. So I sit on the extreme pantser end. I have no idea when I'm sitting down to write what I'm going to actually include the book, who's going to be murdered, or who murdered them. No clue. What I have is an image, a sort of an idea of a setting where they start. And then I throw the characters into that situation and that setting, and then I let them start talking to each other, and the story seems to evolve from there. So it's not really a consciousness of I have these facts and I have to make them fit together, because I think if you did that, it sounds like you're putting things together in a jigsaw and the cracks and the lines between the pieces always show. What it is sort of an immersion in the story. And out of that come all the little details that add that authenticity. Because for me, it's a very authentic experience writing it, because I just go there and I write what these characters are doing. So, of course, there is research involved. So breaking down this first chapter, I knew at the time that I knew in the beginning that this story would be set in Boston in America. I knew I'd left Roland in Shanghai, and so I needed to explain why he ended up in Boston. So it occurred to me that then he would receive the telegram, would find him to explain that Danny Cartwright had died and summon him effectively to Boston. And it would take something of that nature to make him drop everything and go. So he's not the kind of man to, for example, get an invitation for someone saying, oh, we're having a polo match that you might like to attend. Do you want to come to Boston? He's not quite that frivolous. It would take something to make him change his plans, to disappoint his brother and just drop everything and go to America. By the same token, I had to explain what he was doing hanging around Singapore at the time, because I needed to get him part. And this is part of the problem with writing in the 1930s. It takes so long to get anywhere. So I didn't want to start him off in Shanghai, because if I started him off in Shanghai, I would have needed to add another 2 weeks travel to get before I got him to Boston. So I wanted him to be sitting at least in Singapore. And then I had to explain what he was doing in Singapore. And so that's the point at which you start Googling what's interesting about Singapore in 1935. And then I noticed that the King George VI dry dock, which has implications for the impending war, and was really figured in the fall of Singapore in World War II. That I thought, okay, well, let's just talk about that, because that might be useful for a later book. Because I know I intend to write Rowley into the war. The fact that he knows the King George VI dry dock may prove useful in a later book. It may not, but I'll just put it in just in case it does. So that's kind of the way it works. The details sometimes are seeded there, not just to add authenticity to the current story, but as possible threads which I could pick up on in later stories.
Yes, so really what's happening is you get your inspiration of where they're going to be. You start build. You write. You allow the story to come out of you. What's come before that to inform you, so you know how to write that? So you're doing your research as things come into play, to kind of then trigger. Ah, I'm going to use this moment in history. This is how I'm going to bring that in.
And quite often, you'll look up something because you need to have them talk to someone, and you think, well, they might as well talk to a real person who was around at that time. And then all of a sudden the story takes a different arc or a different tangent. So that's where the Panzer element comes into it, because when the book is finished, it sounds as though I plotted all of this, because it all feeds into the later story. But it's just because I allow each character and each event to take me wherever it'll take me.
Yeah, it does feel like you have a general sense of the arc, that it's already established. I am surprised that you're pantsing your research as you go, because it doesn't feel like that. It feels so much more structured when you read it as a reader, and that there are certain points that you potentially could have hung things off. But how fascinating, it went the other way around by the sounds of it. The story started to hang off points that you discovered as you went. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. So I knew, I knew to get him to Boston, it would take the death of Daniel Cartwright. Now, Daniel Cartwright actually appeared in book two. He's a character from book two. And he was this wonderful, absurd character who was only just described as an old friend of Roland's from university. And you didn't get a lot more detail about what the nature of their relationship was. But I always knew at the time that he was such an interesting character that later on in the series, I may want to look more closely at what their relationship was and why they were such good friends. But I didn't do it in book two. In this book, in book 10, I had the opportunity to look at Daniel Cartwright more closely. Of course, it was done posthumously. because Daniel's dead at the very beginning. But it had to be something of that magnitude to actually have Roland drop everything and not only fly himself, and at that time flying was very, very expensive, but fly himself and his three companions.
His tribe.
Yeah, he just flies his entourage, the Scooby gang. So then it developed from there. And of course, there's when you have a dead person, they have family, so then their family walked into the story. Each of them brought their own sort of sub-stories and their own motivations with them, and the story arc shifted to accommodate that. And so it's a constant shifting of the story arc. I had no idea when I started writing it. I knew by the first chapter that it was Danny who was dead, but I had no idea who killed him, who wanted to kill him, who would walk into the story after that. They just did. Now, you follow the old rules of crime fiction in that the murderer has to walk into the story fairly early. So my technique is, in the crime fiction way, is to actually just have a barrage of characters walk in the first two or three chapters, and then I investigate with Roland so that I have a number of characters to look at.
I love that you investigate with Roland, that you're both the detectives in this book as you write the story.
I'm sure he's ahead of me.
It so makes me think of your other book, Crossing the Lines. I can so see where that's come from completely.
It was, yes, Crossing the Lines is more a confession than anything else.
As you say, it's your love story.
Yeah, my love letter to the art of writing. So this is just the way I do it. Now, that's not to say, and I do realise that for a crime fiction, it's a very, very unusual to pants quite as much as I do. Simply because crime fiction is all about logical lines and red herrings that are introduced and
having a framework and a formula almost that you're following.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. There's sort of rules to the puzzle.
Yeah, because the reader expects it on the other end. They're reading a lot of the time to be able to have those moments of satisfaction.
Look, my theory is, so I have an unusual technique even as I write, even as a pantser, in that I watch television while I write. I actually watch television, not just have it on while I write the story. And part of that is, all of that is because, I didn't realise this at the time, this was just my technique. And then somewhere along the line, I ran into Kylie Ladd. She's a wonderful writer, but she's also a cognitive psychologist. And I was explaining this technique of writing while I watch television. And she said, oh, no, that's perfectly sensible in terms of cognitive psychology. You're accessing your subconscious. So she explained to me that your creative center is in your prefrontal cortex, and the prefrontal cortex cannot be accessed directly. So that's why when you lose a word and you're trying to find the word, you can't find it, and then you go away and do something else and it pops into your head. So it's that sort of thing. So what I've trained my brain to do is access my prefrontal cortex by watching television and doing something else, so that I'm not trying to do it directly. So it feels very much, and I sit down and I watch something that, you know, it's that doesn't take up a lot of attention. So it's always something like Midsummer Murders, which has a very steady pace and a very predictable format. So it doesn't require all my attention to follow the story. And I sort of distract about 30% of my brain and the other 70% writes. And so at the end of the episode, I've got, you know, a chapter written, and I'm almost unaware of having written it. So what I figure is that somewhere in my subconscious, there is someone who is plotting and making all of this make sense. There's someone who's understanding themes and red herrings and making sure everything ties off. But that person operating in my subconscious doesn't bother to tell my conscious unless it's absolutely necessary. And so it feels very much to me like this is happening organically and I'm just following Roland through the 1930s.
Is that something you've always done? Just quickly, like, is that how you've always written? Is that, or was that something you came to understand about yourself?
No, that's how, well, see, I didn't know how to write. When I wrote my first book, I had never, ever written anything. I hadn't written a short story or anything outside school. And I was just doing it to occupy time. I thought it was just a hobby. I'll write a novel. And so I didn't know how to do it. So I just did what came naturally, and that's what came naturally, just to sit down and write and see what happened. And I didn't plot because, you know, I have a tendency just to dive into things. And to me, it was exciting to discover things. So really, when you're reading my books, I'm discovering things at the same time as the writer, as the reader, because it's occurring to me or being revealed to me as I write it. And I think that adds a natural pace to the books, because as things get exciting, of course, I write faster because I want to find out what happened.
I'm wondering that. So when you're sort of having those, because there's some fairly violent moments in your books, there's some violent scenes, there's some confronting moments, there's tension, there's suspense, like you hit all of the big crime elements and mystery elements. So are you yourself experiencing those feelings as you write it then?
Oh, yes, absolutely, and very deeply. So it's, you know, even as I write it, and especially when I'm dealing with a scene like that, I quite often dream it as well. So I'll write it and I'll dream it and it'll appear to me like a movie, like I'm there watching what's happening. And I'll see every little nuance of the expressions, and I'll know what they said and what they thought as well. And, it, you know, not all of it makes it onto the page because, you know, part of writing is to know what to leave out. But I experience all of that and I see all of that. It makes the whole process exciting for me and interesting for me, because it keeps that going. I think if I was to plot it beforehand and I knew what was happening beforehand, it would, and I knew who did it and I knew how it came out, I don't know that I would be as excited about writing because there would be no element of funny.
Yeah,
well, so like, well, I know who did it. I don't need to write it. But for me now, you know, I write it because I need to know who did it.
And also it would lose that flexibility that you're talking about, of being able to just go with something as it comes up for you. And it sounds it sounds so much like what people talk about when they say they're channeling. And it really does. It's very DNA for you. It's so interesting to hear you speak about how it flows through you like that. So you were just talking about, though, your first books, and I want to go back there because I really want to sort of drill down more into this writing from history, or writing history into your fiction element. Your first series was the Hero Trilogy, and that was based off Greek mythology. So you've always loved history, and you studied astrophysics?
Physics, yeah. So everything I write about, yeah, I'm not a historian by trade. Mm. I married a historian, but it's not even so much about subjects like history or that sort of thing in particular. It's just the way my gaze falls. So when I read any event or history or current events or a story, I've always been interested in the guy who was standing next to the guy in the spotlight.
Mm.
And I'd wonder, well, what's their story? What are they doing there? And how did they contribute to this? So I've always been fascinated by unwritten history, all the things that happened in the background that just didn't make it to the spotlight. And it's always, I've always thought of looking for the stories in between the stories. So for me, history itself is a scaffolding. It's the story that everybody knows. It's the actual fact that goes in there. But into that is woven a story that nobody knows. And that's where I do my part, where I write the Roland Sinclair novels into the scaffolding of history. When the same thing with the Hero Trilogy, it was written into the scaffolding created by Homer and Virgil. It's really thinking about what also could have happened to result in that same historical report. So I like to think that what I'm writing is a plausible history. It might have happened that way. It didn't, but it might have.
So you want to try and stay true to the general vibe of that period and that time and what people generally associate with it, but you're creating your own world.
Yeah, and I don't contradict reported history at all. So I'm married to an historian. He wouldn't let me do that. So if history said, for example, that De Groot cut the ribbon on the Sydney Harbour Bridge, there is no way that I would have Roland Sinclair come in and cut it.
Right. So there's integrity to elements of history for you.
So if this, I like to think that if you read a Roland Sinclair novel, nothing in the novel will tell you, give you a false impression of what actually happened in history. It'll just give you another story aside from it. And that's just me. There's no law that says that you have to stick to that sort of rule, or that you have to maintain the integrity of history. But for me, that's kind of part of the challenge and part of the puzzle. How do I write something that's new and that turns everything on its head, but still is consistent with recorded history?
Yeah, I think that you've actually hit on something that you say, oh, I don't know if everyone does it, but I think all good historical fiction that I've read does exactly what you've just done. It allows the integrity of the time to stand while creating a fictional scenario for you to be able to experience that in and to be able to have an authentic experience of that time, place, social environment, politics.
Exactly, because it's lots of little stories. It's the little stories, the little human stories behind the big historical events. That I'm particularly interested in, the people that are forgotten by history, the people who are missed by history. And, you know, they're not necessarily forgotten because they're written out of history, though sometimes they were, but sometimes they're forgotten because nobody knows. And with Roland Sinclair, it's that nobody knows how much influence he had on the events of the 1930s because he doesn't speak up. He just goes about his business. And for me, that's the challenge, to make that ring true with what actually happened. And so that's why, interestingly, I have those extracts in there, because I know that every now and then I have to point out what actually happened, you know, what the real bits of history are, because it's every historical fiction writer's aim to make the story so seamless that you don't know what's really history and what I've made up.
That is a really interesting mechanism that you use. So just so that anyone who hasn't read a Solari Gentile book out there or one of the Roland Sinclair mysteries, Solari actually puts these little, like they're snippets from newspapers and moments of history at the beginning of each chapter. And that's what was read out at the very beginning before she went into the extract just now. And that, to me, is a brilliant tool for validating and for connecting themes and validating the time and the space that you're putting these people in without having to actually go in and explain it. Is that why you're doing it?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, you know, when A Few Right-Thinking Men was first written and I sent the manuscript out, I was in the lucky position of having a number of publishers very interested in it. But a lot of them came back saying, look, we love the story. We think, you know, it works really well, blah, blah, blah. But we think in certain instances you have just stretched credibility too far. And those instances that they were talking about were actual events, because history is quite often more crazy than, you know, anything we could make up. And the funny thing about fiction is you don't rely on coincidence, or you don't. There's certain rules about what you can make up, and you tend to it tends not to be as outrageous as what actually happened. But the problem is that as a writer, if people disbelieve or if people think that you've gone too far, you lose them. And you're not there to argue with them and say to them, no, actually, that really happened. I'm not, you know, that part is not the part I made up. And so I inserted these extracts into the manuscript to almost belt and brace the manuscript, to sort of put that validation or that corroboration into the actual book whenever I was to sort of let readers know, or to give them a hint as to the fact that some of the really outrageous things actually happened and were part of recorded history and not the bits that I concocted. So it's really interesting. But then, of course, they became so popular that I have to do it for every single book now. So at the end of every manuscript, and I find them after I write the book. So I write the book, and then I spend a couple of days on Trove finding the extracts to go ahead of it.
So they're not a part of your research as you're writing the book. They come afterwards.
Yep. Absolutely, come afterwards. So, you know, I have I always do my research while I'm writing, or afterwards, in terms of the extracts, but while I'm writing, because part of the problem with doing your research before you write is that you have a tendency to want to write your research. And if you research while you write, it means that the story drives the research and not the other way around.
Very true. I completely understand what you're saying there, and I'm sure that there are a lot of listeners right now out there who have had the exact same experience, especially when you're writing your first book. And I did that mistake, went and researched a whole lot, and then you can see that so much of it was just almost like, and here's all the research.
Well, you know, crap. You've done that work.
No, the book's crap.
Well, you know, and it's also a very efficient way to do it, because it means that your research is targeted. When you're researching in the beginning of a book, you're just researching all over the place and great slabs of everything. You can spend years doing that. And you really need very little of it for the actual story. If you research while you write, your research is targeted. I know I need to find something that would keep Roland in Singapore in 1935. So, you know, that's targeted. It's not, you know, researching Singapore in general or researching the 1935 in general. It just lets you go by that.
Yeah, so you're not spending a month going deep into all of that just to be able to get this one tiny little nugget of gold that ties your story together. That's really interesting way of going about it. I actually have never heard another historical fiction writer speak about their process this way. I'm so glad we chose you to talk about it, because I think usually it comes across so much more structured because of what we talked about before in the underpinning of moments and the hanging of story on moments of history. And for you to find the moments that then drive the story as you're going, I think there's a level of freedom.
You've also got a level of courage. Mm. And so this technique requires courage, because you've got to just trust
the process.
So you will figure out, you will just trust that the story will out.
Yeah.
And in every book that I write, I always get to about 75% of the way through and I think, oh, my God, I've written myself into a corner. You know, I've stuffed it. Mm. I can't finish this book. And at that point, you've just got to really pull your courage together, gird your loins, and keep writing.
Well, you've done it for 10 books now. So it works.
Yeah, it works. But, you know, in every time you come to that halt, you think, is this the time when I can't do it? But you've just got to keep pushing and it'll come out.
Have you ever backtracked? You know, have you ever gone backwards?
No, I always write forwards. I always write forwards and I write chronologically. So I start from the first page, go. And look, my publishers and editors will tell you there's very little structural change to my books. So I tend to go straight to line edit.
Okay. Well, that answers a whole other question I had for you. Right. Was how much of this is happening in the edit? How much of adding the historical detail, the flavoring on top that gives it that level of authenticity?
No, it doesn't happen at that point. Most of my edits are about correcting factual, sort of the fact-checking things. So they'll say to me, oh, that model of car was actually not out till the following year or something of the sort. Or, you know, quite often my research is probably right. I just haven't expressed it well enough. And Michael, my husband, always checks my research, always checks the historical part of it. He's my first editor, so he always picks up if there's a historical inaccuracy. So I know that when I send it to my editor, historically, if they have a problem with something, it's probably that I haven't expressed it properly rather than I've made a mistake in history. But generally, it just goes to mainly to line edits, spelling and, you know, repeated words, that sort of stuff. But part of that is because I'm a lawyer by training. So legal training teaches you to choose your words precisely in the first place. So I think a lot of editing comes out of writers because they get the, you know, the first draft, they're just trying to get the story out on the page. They'll quite often pick a word that means nearly what they want it to mean because they don't want to halt the flow. And I won't. I will not go forward until I have written exactly what I mean. And I choose the word precisely in the first place.
And so therefore, when it comes down to the edit, you've already done so much of that process as you've gone.
Yeah. Look, my edits are usually fairly quick, 2 or 3 days.
Wow.
It's simply because it's because of the way I write that when I put it down, it's exactly what I mean. So when it comes back, most of the edits that come down are things like spelling mistakes. And I have a tendency to overuse ellipses. I love the ellipses. But that sort of thing. So I don't leave things out. I won't go forward because of because I'm telling myself the story as I go, I can't leave a bit of the story out. It's got to actually go forward properly. So I can't, it means that there is actually less editorial because of just for the technique I employ. But it just also means that part of the reason why I'm getting books out so quickly, it's not that I'm much more prolific than most writers. It's just that I don't spend a lot of time in editorial.
How long does it take you to write one of your books just quickly? What's the average?
About 4 months. So it's only 1,000 words a day. 1,000 words a day for 3 months and 1 month of just stuffing around and not actually getting much done. So that's what usually works.
Actually, that's pretty average, yeah. Isn't it, for a writer? Yeah.
Prolific is a lot of the science fiction and fantasy writers. They're pumping out 5,000 words a day. I don't know how they do it. I think the other difference is that there's no downtime for me. I never stop writing. So before the end of one book, I've got the concept for the next book. And so I don't have, you know, quite often a writer will write a book and then they'll take 6 months off, you know, doing other things and then before they start on the next novel. I don't. I just go straight to the next novel.
Okay. So I'm going to rewind back to a part of the conversation you were having before about Michael, because I know that because we've talked about this before, that he was a big part of the inspiration behind the Rowley series. And so do you mind just telling our listeners about how Michael played in and his job as a historian played into you actually going down this path? And also the interest, what triggered you wanting to write this kind of series in that time period?
Sure. So I started writing, I was working as a lawyer, and I just picked it up as a hobby. So I was a serial hobbyist. I'd sort of do things on the side. So I was a lawyer, but I'd pick up stained glassing or gardening or quilting or painting, like pregnancy testing cows, all of those sort of crazy hobbies. I'd just go off and, yeah, I can do that. Why not? I'll have a go. And so writing for me started in very much the same vein. I'd finished the welding course and I thought, oh, what'll I do now? Oh, I'll write a novel. And I sat down and I started writing. What I started writing first was the Greek mythic fiction, so the hero trilogy. And, of course, I'm married to an English history teacher, and he is that incredibly valuable of things. He's a captive editor. If I can give any single writers some advice, if you can marry an editor, that's handy. And I didn't know, at the time I married him, I didn't know that he'd proved to be so useful. Once I started writing, I'd start handing him my books to basically pass a sanity check over. And he'd do that dutifully. And that was just our practice. I'd write, he'd edit and send it back to me. But Michael used to stumble on all the Greek names. Greek mythology is full of Agamemnons and Achilles and Archimedes and, Machaons and so on. And he said he used to have to stop and think, how do I pronounce this, every time he came across it? And he'd grumble at me in his usual way. And one day he just turned around to me and he says, for goodness sake, can't you write something with names like Peter and Paul in it? And write a murder. Everybody loves a murder. And I ignored him, as you do. But one of the things I've come to realize once I started writing is it wasn't like any other hobby. It was like breathing properly for the first time. It was just once I started, I just knew I just wasn't going to stop. This was what I should always have been doing. And I had just, for some reason, missed that fact. Because of the way I write, because of how immersive I am, I go very deeply into my head. And a writer's head is a very attractive and comfortable place for the writer. Now, there's people in there to talk to, there's things to do, exciting things happening, but it's difficult for the people you live with because all of a sudden they're effectively living with someone who is not there, who is always distracted and somewhere else. And I knew that this was an issue because, and quite often that's the problem for me as a writer and for many writers. It's not so much that writing is a difficult life, it's making your writing life work with your real life and getting those two to actually coexist. And I was finding myself drawn into my head and disappearing into my head for vast periods of time and being quite resentful of having to come out to join the real world. And I knew I wasn't ever going to stop writing, but I also had no plans of getting rid of Michael. So I thought I'm going to have to make them work together and live together. So then I started thinking about, well, what if I actually got him interested in my writing? In a way, way more than dutifully editing. And so I actually actively looked for a story that would engage him, that he would really care about. Now, Michael's an historian, and his particular area of expertise is the extreme political movements of New South Wales in the 1930s. which coincidentally is the setting for the first Roland Sinclair book. So basically what I did is I grabbed his thesis and I found a story in it. I wrote a novel into it. And what that does is it means that, one, he's engaged with the topic. Two, it means that I have an expert in the field in the bed next to me. So that makes research very easy, because it's often a matter of turning to Michael and say, and just asking. And three, it just means that I can concentrate on the bit that is natural for me and that I really love, which is the story writing part, and know that Michael will not let me make a mistake with the history. He will not let me play unsupervised in his area of history. So he makes sure that my history is tight. And quite often one of the problems for historical fiction writers is that every person's trying to catch you out on the failure of history. And so I can go into that with the confidence that one of the experts in the field in Australia has actually checked it and made sure that the history part is okay. And so, you know, there's very rarely an anachronism or a failing of that kind in my work. And I can just relax and let myself make things up.
So would you suggest then that anyone who wants to write fiction from history and place
marry a historian, yes.
Marry a historian, well, we've already said that. But failing that, actually go and find an expert in the field who might be interested in being some kind of
mentor.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. And you know, talking with an historian is so much more valuable than reading all the history books on earth. Because you can argue with them, you can test theories, you can check things out. So Michael and I often argue about how the history works, and I figured that if I can convince him that what I'm doing is plausible, then it works. So, you know, often, you know, I'm always saying to him that he'll always talk to me about what men of that era would do generally, and men being the general men, or women of that era being general women of that era. You know, men of that era were typically misogynistic, or were typically racist, or typically classist. And I have to remind him that I'm not writing about the ordinary men of that era. I'm writing about an extraordinary man in that era. And so we'll have this interplay about, you know, how far Roland can go and still be authentic as a character of the 1930s.
Actually, can I pause you there? Because there's a piece in the book that I think reflects this perfectly, that I would like to just quickly read out, because just reflects exactly what you've said about Rolly so perfectly. And it's when it's him and Molly and Jeffrey, and he stands up for Molly and the way Jeffrey's treating her. And then there's another point where he stands up for Edna, actually, and he turns around and someone says something about Edna doing something, and he goes, Edna will just do what Edna wants to do. Kind of, he's got this deep feminism about him.
I'm not even sure it's a feminism, it's an individualism. He doesn't, it applies to every person equally. It does not, he does not ever try to constrain anyone. And I think it's because he's come from a life where he has so many expectations piled on him of how to be a good son and how to be a, you know, how to be a member of his class and, you know, what clubs to join and so on, that, and he's sort of broken free of all of that. He refuses to shackle anyone with his expectations or demand that anybody else act in a certain way. So it's particularly noticeable in his relationships and his attitudes towards women, because typically in the 1930s, men like to control women.
Mm.
And, and dictate to them.
Well, it was just what was done. And women expected it as well. So we're just breaking out of that now, and it's still the norm in many ways. But yeah, there is this section. I'll just quickly read it because I just think it really typifies what you've just talked about. "What on earth is going on here?" Jeffrey Cartwright stalked into the drawing room. He wore a dinner suit. Roland recognised the small leather valise he held at his side as a regalia case. Cartwright was apparently on his way to a Masonic lodge meeting. Molly looked at him, startled. "Jeffers, you're back early?" "I forgot my handkerchief," he said coldly. "What the hell is this? Come to take inventory, Sinclair?" "Don't be silly, Jeffrey," Molly said, standing. Roland followed suit. "I invited Rolly." "Rolly? For God's sake, Molly, surely you're not so desperate as to throw yourself at..." Molly slapped him. For a moment, Jeffrey simply looked at his sister. Then he grabbed her arm and shook it. "Don't think I'm going to let you." Roland stepped in. He placed his hand on Jeffrey Cartwright's shoulder and tightened his grip. "Let go of her, Mr. Cartwright." "Mind your own business, Sinclair. I'm not about to let my sister behave like a common tramp." "That's enough." Roland's temper was beginning to flare now. "For the love of God, Molly, didn't Daniel bring enough disgrace upon this family without you?" Roland stepped between Jeffrey and his sister. "Mr. Cartwright, there is nothing improper going on. Miss Cartwright merely wished to discuss who might have killed your brother." In desperation, and though he felt a little ridiculous resorting to such things, Roland invoked Masonic code in the hope that brotherhood in the craft might carry some weight. "I assure you, sir, I am on the level." That's Rolly the whole time. He's
a man of integrity. Look, he makes mistakes, and I know later on in that book he comes into conflict with Edna because in his desperation to protect her, he crosses the line into trying to constrain her.
Mm-hmm.
He's like all of us. He makes mistakes, but the difference, I suppose, in terms of Rolly, it is genuinely a mistake. It's not an attitude.
That's a really interesting part. I've deliberately avoided it because I think it's something the readers should discover. But that interaction between Edna and Rolly, given their deep connection, and you can see where it comes from. But I loved the way Edna reacted. And once again, it speaks to, I know you shy away from this, but I feel this deep feminism in your books. I really do. It just comes through. Like, and Edna, to me, I love Edna. I think she's the type of woman you'd want to be in that time period, but it would be hard to be.
Well, you know, when I was creating Edna, I knew at the beginning that Roland would have to have a love interest, and I didn't want to be writing Mr. and Mrs. Sinclair Investigate. So I knew that the love interest would have to be unrequited. And so all I had for Edna was that she would have to be someone so extraordinary that readers would believe that Roland would be faithful to her for many books without giving up, that he would be so in love that he would keep carrying a torch for her through several books. And so she emerged out of that and as this extraordinary woman who knows who she is and does not apologize for it. And I quite love that about her. But the thing that I find really interesting is I get lots of letters from readers. Most of them are men. And they seem to be equally admiring of Rolly and in love with Edna. So clearly that kind of feminist character, the strong, independent woman who just does not compromise her freedom, is, funnily enough, attractive as well. So I found that really interesting because I did wonder whether Edna's independence would make her a sort of a threatening figure for men. But the letters I get from men who are in love with Edna,
who actually declare being in love with Edna, are quite lovely and numerous. And quite often they're this. I mean, though, interestingly enough, the letters I get tend to be from older men. The readership that is really diehard Edna is sort of 70 plus.
I love that. It's also people who, you know, who potentially would be able to relate to the time periods coming through, who would, say, understand what strength it would take to be that character at that time.
Exactly. And you know, it's not that she doesn't love Roland. It's not that she doesn't have feelings for him. It's just that she realizes that in the world in which they live, if she was to give in to those feelings, she would become Mrs. Roland Sinclair and nothing.
She would be erased. Yes.
Yep.
She loves herself more. She loves the idea of having her own identity more. She's amazing.
Yeah. And she has her, you know, she's ambitious. She has her art. And she's also, it's almost even more than just societal expectations. She also realizes that she's the kind of person that if she was to allow herself to fall in love with Roland Sinclair, she would love him with all of her heart. And that would take away from her art.
It would be a sacrifice for her to love Roland.
Look, it's a really interesting thing because I remember this from when I had my children. And so I had my children, I was working as a lawyer, and I was determined that I was not going to let my career flag by the fact that I had children. So, you know, my eldest in particular came to board meetings with me from the time he was 3 weeks old. I just mum take all the meetings, and I just continued working and carried on. There was, you know, a couple of days when I was in the hospital, but otherwise I continued working. I was absolutely determined to do this. But what I had not expected is how besotted I would be with this child, how in love I would be, so much so that I could have spent hours just looking at him. And I remember at the time thinking, oh gosh, this is crazy. I could sit here and be perfectly happy for the rest of my life just looking at this child and never do anything again. And of course that passes with time, but I didn't know it at the time. And I think that's where Edna is. I think Edna knows herself enough to know that if she allowed herself to fall in love with Roland, that love would be so strong that she is afraid she would lose her ambition and her will to do other things. And so she protects her art by not allowing herself to get that close. And bearing in mind Edna's history, her mother was an artist who got married and had a child and ended up taking her own life because of the loss of her art. And so Edna was raised never to belong to a man for that reason. And so she has that history in her. I mean, the thing with Roland is that he probably also would be so consumed by his love for Edna that he might never paint again, but he doesn't care. He's, you know, for him, he's not that ambitious. He's quite happy. If he had Edna, he would put down his brush and never paint again, if that's what it meant. But the difference is Edna has always been more ambitious and more in love with her place in art than Roland's. Roland paints because he wants to, not because he's driven to.
So I think this brings to a really interesting point in writing historical fiction. It's having to get things like the language right, the interpersonal relationships right, the way people would behave at that time, because behaving in the 1930s, as opposed to the way you might behave now, the relationships between men and women back then, as opposed to now, the language we speak, the way we hold ourselves, the expectations, all of that is so vastly different. So I know you say you pants it all, but how do you channel all of those details through? Like, how does a writer come to authentically translate that? Is like, were you listening to the way people spoke at the time? Were you looking at pictures of how they dressed? Were you watching old movies? Was any of that coming into play for you?
Well, I'm an immigrant. So my parents came to Australia from Sri Lanka after I was born. But being of the age that they were, they grew up learning English in school, but they learned colonial English. So the way my parents speak is pretty much the way people would speak in the 1930s. So the dialogue is very natural to me because those are the English patterns with which I grew up. And so, you know, it's inherent. It's an inherent grammar style. And I remember when I first was writing, I remember one of the editors was saying, well, Solari uses a very old-fashioned way of speech tagging. So I think it's about whether you say Peter said or said Peter. And one of them is very old-fashioned, and I use the very old-fashioned one. And that's just naturally what I used. It wasn't that I was thinking I will use one that's consistent with the 1930s. That's just what I went to first. And a lot of my language patterns are quite old. And Sri Lanka at the time was a very colonial sort of English sort of Commonwealth country at the time. And the language that was taught was very colonial English with lots of Englishisms, like you know, even now I use words like daft, and I remember when I was working, I had a colleague who was from England, and he was listening to me talk one day, and he fell about laughing, and he said, you know what's really funny, when you talk you use all these expressions that could be English that sound like someone from home, but you say it with an Australian accent. and it sounds bizarre. So I think the dialogue in that sense was very, very natural for me. In that, the rest of it, I always had a feeling that human beings are human beings. So it doesn't change, you know, whether you're talking about the 1930s or the 2020s or the 1600s or Bronze Age Greece, people still felt love and they still felt jealousy and they still felt resentment and loneliness. So in creating characters, you just create human beings and you just concentrate on the fact that human beings have certain reactions. People don't react differently. They may express it differently, but they don't react differently. People still get angry, that people still get hurt. It may be, you know, nowadays people start swearing at you when they get hurt, whereas in the 1930s they, you know, had a more of a stiff upper lip or they expressed it differently, but the emotion is still there. So that's what I play with. In relation to that, the rest of it, I just sort of use my imagination. I think a lot of it is that the 1930s. I'm often quite fond of saying this. The 1930s is within memory, but it's usually secondhand memory. People remember the stories that their parents told them. So a lot of their imaginations is coming into what they know as well. And occasionally you talk to someone who was there in the 30s. So at the moment I'm in correspondence with a lovely gentleman who's reading all the Roland books, and he's 95. but I kind of figure that after all those years, your memories are also affected by what's come afterwards. So authenticity is a matter of perspective. I think is what I'm trying to say. What makes something authentic is also a matter of perspective. And one of the things I often tell people is Roland's dialogue, even though it conjures the 1930s, is not absolutely faithful to the 1930s, because what you're doing as a historical fiction writer is you're trying to give people a notion of the person, a notion of the character. So Roland in the 1930s was a progressive and modern man.
But yet, if I was to be really true to the way he would have spoken, what I would have conjured was Alexander Downer.
Oh my goodness.
Because the upper class particularly had a very, very particular accent and a very refined way of speaking that in this day and age would either conjure someone very elite or it would conjure someone very camp.
Mm.
Neither of these things fitted with Rowley. So you have to modify the language so that it it creates the impression of that era. It harks to that era. And yet it is also indicative of the character that you're trying to create so that you don't, by being too authentic, leave an inauthentic character in the reader's mind.
So I guess really what you're saying to people who want to write historical fiction, I guess the point that we really need to remember here is the fiction. That you aren't writing history.
Relax.
You are writing fiction. And even though I think that there's so much weight around writing historical fiction for a writer because of this sense that, like you said, people go out there and pick this and pick that and pick this. But at the end of the day, just like any other author out there writing any other part of the future or the past or the present or anything, it is just a fiction story. And it's not meant to. And I guess exactly what you've said, probably some of the best advice is just write it so that people can feel like they're there, but you don't have to worry so much about getting all those tiny details right because you'll probably forget about the story.
And remember that you're talking to an audience of today with all the nuances and all the expectations and all the beliefs that we have today, and you're not talking to someone from the 1930s. So the other thing is just to relax. I mean, the tag I never call myself an author or a historical fiction author. I tend to think of myself as a storyteller, and that's my job, to tell you a story that takes you away, that that takes you to the 1930s or what you believe to be the 1930s, and tells you a little bit about the history at the same time.
So the last question there, I think this leads in quite nicely actually, is because I know that part of the reason you also chose to write about this was because you wanted to excavate what led to the Holocaust
and
Nazism, really, fascism to that degree. And your books are like a vehicle for you to be able to use history as a way, I guess, as well, of exploring the modern day and what we're living in now and being able to refer to it. There is an art to being able to achieve that in fiction where people can make those parallels. Can you just quickly talk about being able to use history in your fiction as a mirror and almost a crystal ball in some ways for where we are now and where we might go in the future?
I think when I started writing it, I had no idea that we would track so closely. In fact, I was kind of smug. I thought that first book told the tale of how Australians were different, how we stepped up to the abyss of fascism and we stepped back. That there was something inherently different about Australians, that we could not be seduced into that kind of thinking. That we were just too easygoing or too relaxed or too egalitarian to ever have that kind of thing happen here. And then the federal government started locking up refugees in concentration camps offshore. And I started to think, whoa, maybe I was a little bit overconfident in that. And things started changing in the world. I think the reason that I can draw those parallels, or that the parallels work, is that what's current is on my mind at the time that this story is emerging to me. Mm-hmm. And so it sort of, so similarities become very salient. Because I'm thinking about what's going on today, And so when times or events in history pop up that strike a chord with me, they find their way through that strange person in my subconscious who's actually plotting this stuff to come out in my books in a story from the 1930s. I would caution against people writing polemics and preaching at people in historical novels. If you set out to do that, it will sound like that. It will sound as though you're preaching at people, and that is a really, I wouldn't have thought it's a great way to gain a readership. If it comes out, it will come out naturally because you're engaged with your own community and your own time and the problems of your own time. The parallels will become salient because it's what you're interested in and it's what your eyes are drawn to.
It's funny. I find one of the ways you've most effectively done that, because yours certainly are not preaching. It's just a part of the fibre of your story, which is why I feel like you very skillfully thread this through. And I guess the way you say it's all very organic in the way you write, that's obviously why it comes through. But one of the best ways you do it is through the characters you've chosen. Those characters, it's almost like you've set them up to each be able to hold these certain themes as you go through your stories and provide both sides of a spectrum. And I find you do that very well. You seem to have set up a structure within those four particularly that always enable an exploration of some sort.
I think fundamentally with those characters, what is at the center is loyalty. Mm. So I remember reading once that writers always show their hand about the values that are most important to them in their books. And clearly one of the values that's most important to me is loyalty. Mm. So you know that with the four of them, regardless of what conflicts or what different ways they perceive things comes up, they're always very loyal to each other. And so they can go out in the world trusting that three other people have their back at all times. And characters don't exist as frozen in time. They change, they develop, they take on themes, they are changed by each story. And so I suppose in a way they become reflective of the story, because there is this symbiotic relationship between plot and character. Each plot changes each character and develops each character. The nature of each character guides each plot. And so I suppose that is probably why they are so useful as expressing the themes of the time, because they are creatures of their time.
That makes so much sense, actually, when you put it like that. I am going to end this on what we always ask, which is, what are your four top tips for people who want to write from history, write fiction from history?
Tip number one, don't be afraid. They're only words. And a lot of people seem to think that once they put the words down, they can't be changed. That's not the case. So just start, just begin, and do it boldly and unafraid. And know that, you know, it's not brain surgery. No one is going to die if you make a mistake. The second is to remember there are no rules. Everybody will talk to you about the rules of writing and the rules of historical fiction and the rules of detective fiction or whatever, but there aren't. There's just methods that people have tried that have worked for them and haven't worked for them. And if they're useful to you, employ them, but if they're not, just write in a way that's natural. Three, and this is for writing in general, find a way to write that makes you happy while you're actually doing it. There are many writers out there that love having written but find the actual process of writing painful and difficult to endure. You'll be spending a lot of hours writing if you're going to finish a novel, and it would be sad to think that you spent all those hours in anguish, regardless of what the outcome was. So if you can find a way to love the process of putting one word after the other, then, you know, then you're guaranteed a happy outcome, regardless of whether your book ever gets picked up, whether it becomes a bestseller, people buy it, because you can't control those things, but you can control what joy you have in the actual process. Finally, I would always say to people who are writing historical fiction to remember that they are writing about extraordinary people, and as much as there are trends in the way people behave in a particular era, there are always people who stand against the tide, who don't go with the pack, and they are often the most interesting people and deserving of being your protagonist. Is that four?
That's four, and that's so good. I love the one about the joy in your process. I don't think we focus on that part of the writing enough, that we should have joy in the process of writing and find ways it can ignite that joy.
Exactly. I can't understand why people would do it otherwise, because there's no money in it.
That's true. We did a whole episode on that. None. Okay, that's why all the women are starting to self-publish. We'll earn our own money.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Okay, that has been such a great interview. Thank you so much, Solari. I think you've given everybody huge amounts to think about and apply to their own writing life. Wonderful.
Oh, well, thank you, Kel. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, as always. And I look forward to the next time we get to chat.
Yep, that will be the next book, especially if you're writing a whole new one that's going to be a bit like crossing the lines.
Can't yes, letters from Leo. Okay.
Okay, you have a wonderful day. Thank you.
You too. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Writes for Women podcast. If you've got a minute and you love the podcast, can you please head over to where you're getting your podcast and give us a rating or review? They're super important in the podcasting space, and it's basically the way that other people get to find us and listen to us too. Also, don't forget to head on over to our website, www.writesforwomen.com, where you'll find our newsletter, our blog posts, every episode we've done, the Writes for Festivals podcast as well. And if you want to, you can sign up to our Patreon page, which basically gives us a few dollars every month to make this podcast. All of our Patreon subscribers get something a little extra. So have a look and see if it's something that you'd be interested in doing. For the people who are already subscribing to our Patreon account, we love you, we appreciate you, and we thank you. It really does make a difference. So thanks. You can also find Writes for Women on Facebook at Writes for Women and on Twitter at W4W Podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all this information, just sign up to the newsletter, because we pop it all in there. I think that's all the housekeeping stuff done. Thanks for listening to another episode of Writes for Women and joining us for another year. This podcast episode was produced and edited by Kel Butler from Listen Up Podcasting. Podcasts for a positive world.